Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and often later at alexlinder.com. Now, we're going to pick up with part three, and this would be for us segment six, but more importantly, part three, The Politician, of Revelo P. Oliver's America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative. And so this will be comparatively short. We're going to try not to have these almost three-hour sessions. So America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative, Part 3, The Politician. 1. In 1958, my writing for National Review brought me to the attention of Mr. Robert H.W. Welch, W.E.L.C.H. Jr., Robert H.W. Welch, Robert Welch, who began by correspondence and telephone, an acquaintance that progressed during the year to what I believed to be friendship. Some of you will know who Mr. Welch is, but we'll get to that shortly. Mr. Welch was a man of some wealth and had attained a certain prominence at that time. He was one of the proprietors of a large firm that distributed wholesale chocolate and other ingredients used by the manufacturers of candies and similar confections. He had been an officer of the National Association of Manufacturers and a candidate for the office of Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts. He had published an admirable book, May God Forgive Us, and he issued at regular intervals a private periodical called One Man's Opinion. He owned some stock and debentures at the corporation that then published National Review, and he was disturbed by the periodical's tendency toward frivolity and superficiality. It was not only assuming the mannerisms of the pseudo-literary cliques that flourish in the squalor and miasma of the world's largest Jewish city, New York City, but, despite or because of the preponderant influence of editors who claim to have defected from the Communist Party, Max Eastman and others who were writing essentially neocons. Not called that yet because that name didn't come into vogue until the Irving Kristol in the late 60s. So Welch is on a somewhat related to the financial backing of National Review, and he's not liking the former communists and the silliness or superficiality of it. Despite or because of the preponderant influence of editors who claimed to have defected from the Communist Party, it increasingly minimized or ignored the existence of an alien-directed conspiracy in the United States. It consistently implied that what was happening to our nation was a spontaneous and native aberration, to be combated with witticisms and sophisticated tolerance, as though it were no more important than quarrels over literary and artistic standards, such as followed the production of Victor Hugo's Hernani in France, or as drove Handel from England to Dublin. Mr. Welch and I seemed to be in complete agreement about the plight of our nation and civilization, about which, when we met, we spoke, so far as I know, with candor and unreservedly. So somehow in the late 50s, Welch becomes, who's not liking the trend of National Review, becomes aware of Revelo Oliver, who knew Buckley and was writing for it at that time and other publications. So back then, there's more of an amalgam of the right wing isn't so divided by the racialist stuff. The Jews haven't yet driven everybody who might have racial views completely out. And that general tenor in the country is you're still allowed to say certain things that you wouldn't be allowed to say in later decades, particularly the rise of social media. They'd find out that you said them, even on social media, private, you know, publishing, and hound you from your job. On 1 October 1958, I received by first-class mail, registered with return receipt demanded, a bulky manuscript of 304 pages, which I had agreed by telephone to accept on the conditions stated on it. Quote, confidential and for your eyes only. The manuscript, of which my copy was purportedly number 13, had apparently been produced from typewritten copy by an office duplicator and was entitled The Politician. It contained a damning review of the career of Eisenhower. followed by a prospectus for the formulation of a national society, then unnamed but later to be known as the John Birch Society, and for the promotion, as an instrument of that society, of the periodical renamed American Opinion, and published regularly 11 times a year. So this is the what leads to the founding of American Opinion, the national, the what leads to the founding of the John Birch Society, JBS, and its organ of opinion, the American Opinion, its magazine, and this book that led to this, The Politician, about Eisenhower. Remember the famous jibe. Eisenhower, upon Welch's accusing him of being a communist, Eisenhower isn't a communist, he's a golfer. Totally different mentality. But The Politician was a brilliant piece of work, made the more cogent by its few defects. A few scabrous details of Eisenhower's career had been overlooked, but such oversights are inevitable when one man collects data from very numerous, diverse, and often obscure sources. The occasional stylistic defects merely intensified the impression that the author wrote with deep earnestness and absolute sincerity. The Politician told me nothing new. I had previously regarded Eisenhower, as did officers in the army who had long outranked him, as a hopelessly incompetent booby and toady, a mere puppet devoid of both principles and understanding, manipulated by Franklin Roosevelt and his successors, much as puppets are manipulated in a Punch and Judy show. Welch went much further and attempted to prove that Eisenhower was instead, quote, a dedicated, conscious agent of the communist conspiracy. The prospectus for a national anti-communist society was equally convincing. The organization of a powerful nucleus of influential and patriotic citizens, direct quote, recruited from the upper middle class, and especially including the more prosperous businessmen and manufacturers, and operating with both determination and discretion, could give our enemies the first effective opposition they had encountered in this country. And when I heard the details of the plan, it seemed eminently feasible. It was to be a much improved and more tightly structured version of Colonel Hadley's Paul Revere's, plural, Paul Revere's, Colonel Hadley's Paul Revere's, an anti-communist society that had flourished and established chapters throughout the nation, from Boston to San Diego, in the early 1930s, and had then seemed likely to attain great political power within a few years. I accepted an invitation to participate in the foundation of the society in Indianapolis on 8 and 9 December 1958. I was the only man present who was not wealthy. So he might be like the house intellectual, or he's looking for a house intellectual for an organization of rich businessmen who are anti-communist. There were, as I recall, 14 men present in addition to Robert Welch, whose conduct of the meeting confirmed my belief in his complete sincerity. I was especially impressed by his frankness about his own beliefs. There were several Christians among the wealthy men whom he hoped to enlist as founders of the new society, including even one of whom Welch told me, "Believe it or not, every night he gets down on his knees beside his bed and prays to an old man with a white beard up in the clouds to increase his profits." Direct quote. But knowing this, Welch did not dissemble or evade. He candidly stated at the meeting, and later in print, that he was not a Christian and held no religious faith whatsoever. His confidence was in the blind force of nature that had produced the evolution of life on this planet, from the first amoeba-like organism to the mammals, from quadrupeds to anthropoids, and from the Neanderthaler to the best representatives of the highest species of mankind. An evolution that had tended upward from the first, and, he believed, would continue upward in the future. So somewhat like what Peirce believed, man and superman, Bernard Shaw, the cosmotheist sort of point of view, that evolution is dedicated to the upward ladder. This belief is obviously atheism, although Carruth, in his well-known verses, was able to give it a poetic coloring as a vague pantheism. Quote, "Some call it evolution, and others call it God." Welch's avowal of atheism in circumstances in which it could and did operate to his disadvantage, it deprived him of the support of one wealthy man, who thought the avowal imprudent and refused to participate, and may have influenced the two others who withdrew, seemed to me to guarantee his honesty. And on the basis of our complete agreement about objectives and strategy when we conferred after the Foundation, I gave him an unlimited confidence such as I have reposed in no other man. I intend this book to be disfigured by no puerile attempt at self-justification, so I must confess that even today I cannot decide in my own mind whether I was cozened. C-O-Z-E-N, whether he was tricked. So he says, look, I, you know, this guy's not even a Christian, so we agree on the atheism. I agree on his objectives and his strategy, and I thought he seemed sincere and honest, and I don't even know today. I gave him more of my confidence than I have any other man, and even today, long after the fact, I'm not sure whether he tricked me or not. I am aware that Welch was a master salesman and the author of a manual that teaches salesmen how to gain the confidence of their customers, and I have, I believe, considered and pondered all the indications and inferences that can be advanced in support of an argument that the Birch Society was a cunning hoax from its very first inception. But nevertheless, when I recall the conversations and related incidents of that time, I should conclude that Welch was then sincere in his purpose and totally dedicated to the enormous task he had undertaken, were I not aware that vanity may subconsciously incline me toward an explanation that absolves me from the humiliation of having been merely a dupe. So he's not denying the possibility that the John Birch Society was set up as a false front from the start. In 1958, the situation was already critical and nearly desperate. Whether the Birch Society could have succeeded had the original plan and corresponding strategy been followed, I do not know. When one looks back from 1980, one is apt to consider hopeless an effort to undermine and overthrow a power that had effectively occupied the United States and had almost total control over the press, the radio, the schools, the bureaucracy, and the politicians. And it may even seem as fantastic as the story tale about the Jack who climbed the beanstalk and slew the ogre that fed on the blood and bones of Englishmen. But in 1958, rather than 1980, in 1958, it seemed that there was a chance of success. Not, as we candidly admitted, a great chance, but a chance which, though slender, saved the effort from being merely foolhardy. And we know from history that resolute troops, under sagacious commanders, have sometimes obtained brilliant victories over overwhelmingly superior forces arrayed against them under overconfident or inept generals. Our estimate in 1958 was that the chances of success were at best 1 in 10, assuming both highly competent strategy and a large measure of the luck that, as Thucydides observed long ago, plays so large a part in all contests between opposing forces. Whether or not that estimate was overly optimistic, the estimate of potential support probably was excessive. One cannot exclude the hypothesis that Welch was at first sincere in his purposes and only later captured by the enemy, perhaps under the dual pressure of financial exigencies, a phase of the operation with which I had no concern and of which I knew almost nothing. He didn't know about the money behind Welch. And an embittering discovery that the American bourgeoisie as a whole did not have the measure of intelligence and instinctive will to survive with which it had been credited in the estimates. Now, we might add that here you see Welch and Oliver going after the exact opposite of what Hitler went. Hitler went after the working class, the people, the masses, the lower order, the base of the pyramid, and they're going after the upper middle class, which is a very thin stratum. And the upper middle class, the bourgeois, has certain psychological traits and characteristics that are easy to identify, and among them is very, very high self-regard. Generally, they're cowardly and self-regarding are the downside of them. What's in it for me? They're not willing to do anything that will put their income or their social status at risk. So that makes them unfit to be a revolutionary. On the positive side, they may have good respectable behavior because they put a lot of stock into respectability. They may have good bank accounts. They may have some resources to back. They may have professional degrees. They may have actual technical abilities. So that's them as a class versus the proles, who might be brawnier and have nothing to lose and don't have so many skills or whatever, but they're willing to go all the way. In war, and in contest for political control of a nation. So anyway, he's saying that they overestimated the bourgeois they would be appealing to, like the people that National Review would, even today, would be writing for. Or I suppose American Opinion would be directed at. It's still around, just not really much more than a laughing stock these days. In war, and in contest for political control of a nation, strategic plans are necessarily secret and conditional. They become worthless if divulged, and dangerous if known to the enemy, and they must always be made in terms of multiple contingencies, i.e. if the enemy attacks at point A, we will do this. If they attack at point B and are thrown back, we will do that. But if the enemy retreats, we will follow plan X unless we suspect a ruse, and so implement plan Y, and so on. A general, however, cannot dishearten his troops by telling them he has foreseen a possible defeat, and no society can tell prospective recruits that in possible future contingencies they may be necessary to go underground, or it may be necessary to go underground. Your upstanding bourgeois, man of means, with a house, and you know, he's going to go underground and become a political radical. One would defeat oneself by announcing publicly that one does not attack the Zionists because, A, one wants to leave open the possibility of a schism among the Jews, when many of them become impatient of the financial demands put upon them and foresee the logical consequences to themselves of Zionist agitation, and, B, one heartily endorses the announced objective of the Zionist, that of removing all Jews from this country, and one wishes them such success in grabbing so much of Asia Minor as that the Jews will have a large country of their own, and no longer have the excuse for remaining as unwanted and troublesome aliens in the countries of other peoples. For that matter, in 1958, even a hint of a rational wish for Zionist success would have evoked an outcry from the many Americans who, imbued with the idiotic notion that they have a Christian obligation to assure the welfare of everyone in the globe except themselves, would have wailed over the misfortunes of the, quote, poor Arabs who had been and were going to be dispossessed, while simultaneously wailing over the sorrows of the, quote, poor Jews who were not given complete possession of the territory they fraudulently claimed as an ancestral homeland. That's in quotes, ancestral homeland. And he, who's a scholar and knows much about that region and the languages, says that the Jews' claim is bogus. Failing to allow for such illogical fixations in the public could be as fatal in an anti-communist campaign as was Nye's misdirection of Derlon at Waterloo. I know of no instance during the first year and a half of the Birch Society's existence in which Welch made to me considered statements that I am sure he knew to be false. So from the founding through the first year and a half, he's saying Birch appeared to him to be sincere, to speak with and write with candor, and he represented that at the meeting that he went to, the founding meeting. So he believed in Birch at least through the first year and a half, and that ends the section one of part three. Section two. And there are I think three total sections to this session. So section two picks up. In retrospect, it is now clear that the Birch Society failed in the autumn of 1960 and should have been disbanded to leave open the field for a potentially effective substitute. I must confess, however, that that was not clear to me at the time. What happened, if I was not misinformed, is this. A Jew on the staff of a newspaper in Chicago, having been supplied with a copy of The Politician, this novel about Romana Clef about Eisenhower, made at a public meeting and in his newspaper the quite truthful charge that Welch had called Ike Eisenhower a communist. So somehow a Jew gets a copy and puts this in the Chicago newspaper that Welch is calling Eisenhower a communist. The Jew's attempt to create a scandal aroused little interest and was echoed in only one other newspaper, until a member of the council of the John Birch Society, in a panic, yelled to the press that he had always adored dear old Ike, and that the politician was just a foolish letter by Robert Welch that had nothing, absolutely nothing whatsoever, to do with the Birch Society, which would never think about being disrespectful to the president of our glorious nation. Instead of disavowing this flagrantly mendacious statement and announcing the resignation of the pusillanimous member of the council, who to be sure was a former director of the Federal Reserve and a major contributor of financial support, as I urged, instead of disavowing this idiot, Welch felt obliged to put himself on record as telling lies without the slightest possibility of deceiving the enemy, whose possession of at least one copy of the politician was soon made certain by the printing in newspapers of photographic reproductions of one or two passages in it. He asseverated that, 1, the politician, of which something like 1,000 copies had by that time been distributed, quote, in strict confidence, was just a private letter that had been only sent to a, quote, few sick friends to stimulate discussion of an, quote, hypothesis. So he's walking away from his own words. 2, the politician, which proposed the formation of a nucleus of influential and patriotic citizens, had nothing, no nothing, to do with the formation of the John Birch Society, and had been, quote, disavowed, presumably by the other founders, when that society was formed. The fact was that the politician had presumably been read and been at least tacitly approved by every man present at the meeting in Indianapolis, and was so far from having been disavowed by anyone, except possibly in private comments of which I had no knowledge, that I recommended them, and later that no one who had not read and approved the document should be admitted to membership in the Birch Society. So he's confusing everybody and being mendacious in saying that the politician has nothing to do with JBS. Rather than reject the member who freaked and soiled himself and disavowed, he should have disavowed that member and been honest, as Oliver recommended. Members of the council were requested, and members of the salaried staff were instructed, to endorse these falsehoods, and even not to deny the banker's statement that, quote, most of those who have read the Welch letter disagree with the conclusion. Thus began the period of almost 3 years during which everyone who spoke for the Birch Society was placed in an acutely embarrassing position. If he had read the politician and was not willing to lie outright, he had to resort to equivocation and evasion. If he had not read it, he confessed that he was a person in whom Welch did not have sufficient confidence to show him a copy. Similar to Semitical correctness, they get you to exceed in your own undermining morally by forcing you to tell lies. Can't do that and maintain your integrity. The politician was really a quite incomplete survey of Eisenhower's career, and quite mild in comparison with what could have been written, but it raised or suggested questions about his origins, and especially about his complicity in the foul and horrible crimes committed on his orders in Europe, that would have made it clear that the reference to him as a communist agent was really euphemistic. It represented, therefore, a certain menace to the power that had clandestinely occupied the United States, but it is noteworthy that while the Chicago Jews screech was uttered on 5 August 1960, the creation of a real scandal did not begin until December of 1960. Only then did it seem certain that Welch, instead of publishing and defending his work, was going to disclaim a connection between it and the society that was under his absolute control, and was going to try to keep a secret, a black book, of which there were already in the hands of the enemy copies from which an unlimited number of photocopies could be made. Only then did the Jewish cowboys decide to stampede their Aryan cattle in the direction in which they desired to drive the herd, and their most expert outriders, both Jews and hirelings, began to whoop and yell about the wickedness of being disrespectful to their stooge or accomplice, dear old Ike. Their press and radio began a deafening clamor that did stir the boobs who had been captivated by the old scoundrel's fatuous grin, bumbling speech, and uncouth manners. And as soon as it became apparent that Welch was on the run, even honest reporters joined the pack, actuated by the very instinct that makes a dog pursue a fleeing rabbit. I was not greatly disturbed. In fact, although I should have preferred to avoid a scandal at that time, once it had occurred, I did not regret it. I was even pleased. The obvious thing to do was to wait patiently while the clamor grew ever louder and shriller, and the scandal gained momentum through the spring, summer, and early autumn of 1961, until everyone in the country who could read a newspaper, watch the boob tube, listen to a radio, or hear conversation in his office or club had heard about the awful and secret, quote, black book, unquote, that had, believe it or not, called dear old Ike a communist. It was ascertained that through wealthy intermediaries, it would be possible to buy in advance from one of the largest printing establishments time and overtime for the production of a book, of which the nature would not be known until a few minutes before the copy was distributed to the waiting linotype operators, so that, within the time of a long weekend, 100,000 copies of The Politician, in an inexpensive paperback edition, could be ready for shipment, while the presses continued to roll. So let them do free advance PR advertising for you, and then print the book and put it out in mass numbers. The enemy had so excited universal curiosity about the secret and shocking black book that other members of the council and I were convinced that a million copies could have been sold within a few weeks, incidentally netting for the society a very handsome profit. The enemy had provided us with a strategic opportunity that we could never have obtained for ourselves. Great generals owe victory to the enemy's blunders more often than to their own most effective subtle maneuvers. The moment for the counterattack came, and it was much more than a moment, it was months, a whole year, while the general exhibited only tergiversation, that's a sort of like treachery or treason, turning your back on your cause, a big National Review word I first learned from William F. Buckley, but here we find Oliver using a tergiversation. So he had a whole, the iron was hot for a whole year when he could have struck and sold a million copies, but the general, Welch, exhibited only tergiversation and procrastination. In justice to the 20 other members of the council, I must say that a majority of them always favored publication of the book at the right time, and that at least two of them repeatedly offered to underwrite personally the expense of getting it into production. So it wasn't a matter of money, it was a matter of will that they didn't produce the book. It was the general, and the general alone, small g, who refused to stir, alleging an endless variety of pretexts that were more or less plausible, especially to persons to whom he confided his distrust of some of his closest associates, and his reasons for invoking at one meeting of the council his authority to revoke instantly the membership of any one or all of them. So the months and the years passed while the general hid behind his secretaries in Belmont, or at last reluctantly ventured into public to talk generalities and dodge specific questions. And so, for almost 3 years, the American public was daily told that dear old Ike had been libelously called a communist, while the evidence on which that conclusion had been based was kept from them in a, quote, secret, unquote, book, of which the author even tried to recall the copies he had distributed. Everyone was warned about a professedly patriotic organization that was admittedly, quote, monolithic, and under the absolute direction of one man, a man who had clandestinely circulated a defamatory book so outrageous that its contents had to be concealed from almost all his followers, a book so preposterous that almost no one was convinced by it, not even the author's closest associates, who had so little respect for his expert judgment that they did not take his statement seriously, and so little loyalty to him that they publicly repudiated his work. I cannot sufficiently express my admiration and esteem for the thousands of Americans who remain loyal to the Society in these circumstances, and even more of the almost 80,000 men and women who, during this time, came forth voluntarily to affiliate themselves with a society so covered with almost universal opprobrium, not because they believed the silly pretense that the Black Book had no connection with the Birch Society, but because they knew from their own investigations or sensed in their hearts that the Black Book must be right. I wish it were possible to salute them with the honor they deserve, and of which I was always mindful. I do not know what pressures, financial or other, Welch may have been under, or what deals he may have made. I had no leisure to investigate and verify the innumerable explanations given me, often purportedly based on secret information from private intelligence sources. The excuses he's using not to produce the book. I was teaching full-time in a major university, giving graduate courses, directing doctoral dissertations, and necessarily conducting research in classical philology. Every remaining moment of my time was devoted to my share of the work for the society. I had assumed editorial responsibility for a large part of each issue of American Opinion, in addition to writing it copiously for it. I spoke frequently in public and often in private on behalf of the Society, and appeared on the platforms of organizations with which the Society was to maintain an unofficial liaison. I undertook certain negotiations in which Welch was unwilling to appear personally, and other activities for the Society entailed a voluminous and sometimes exacting correspondence. So this is the man in his full powers doing a massive amount of work, fully involved in the Society as we break into the 1960s. That ends section two. Section three, which is the final one, not too long. The 3 years of mystification about the Black Book came to an ignominious end in June 1963, long after the strategic opportunity had been irretrievably lost. So the hype is gone, and the Society just looks foolish, and they haven't published the book. Welch then published and put on sale a counterfeit that he passed off on the public as the text of his, quote, private letter. In this first and expensive edition of The Politician, the text was reproduced from the typewriting to lend verisimilitude to the pretense that it had been photographed from the text distributed in the fall of 1958, and the binding was made to simulate that of manuscripts typewritten and bound in offices. So he's trying to fake them out. There was a printed preface in which Welch repeated the stale old lies about a, quote, private preface, a private, quote, private unfinished manuscript for limited confidential distribution, unquote, with which the John Birch Society, quote, never had any connection in any way, unquote, and which had been, quote, disavowed by, quote, the founders of the Society, to which was added the unblushing assertion that, quote, the Council of the Society long ago officially made it clear that this was purely a personal problem of my own and with which they wanted nothing whatsoever to do in any way. Now, isn't this just flat passing bizarre? Unless there's some hidden explanation, it just doesn't make any sense. At the end appeared a copious bibliography and detailed documentary notes that, as was not stated, had been compiled to substantiate the text on very short notice by the most competent member of the staff in Belmont, Dr. Francis X. Gannon, who produced a work of great accuracy, finding and assembling data from literally thousands of sources by often working 20 hours a day and at the cost of a permanent impairment to his eyesight. Not sure if that guy didn't write for the original American Spectator as well. The purported photographic reproduction of the original was a shabby hoax. The prospectus for the Birch Society and its organ, American Opinion, was entirely omitted. What was even more dishonest, the text had been thoroughly censored to eliminate almost all of the many references to Jews, and to eliminate or modify the more forthright statements about Eisenhower. Even the passage in the original that had been reproduced photographically in newspapers in 1959 and 1960 was rewritten to make it gentle. So audacious a fabrication, tantamount to a forgery, was deemed safe because by June 1963 the public had lost interest in what Welch might or might not have said and was unlikely to recall what it had read years before on a subject that had become merely boring. This counterfeit and the many subsequent editions of it were purchased in large quantities and distributed in good faith by many members of the Birch Society for the personal profit of Robert Welch. Very curious behavior. I must confess that despite all this, I continue to work to the best of my ability and the limit of my strength for the Birch Society. It was almost a year before I began to entertain suspicions which the most ingenious explanations did not entirely lull, and another year before I decided to resign, and then, for good reasons, I postponed my resignation until 30 July 1966. The following pages contain selections from the large quantity of my writing that was published in American Opinion, JBS magazine. In making these selections, I have not deleted the passage laudatory of Robert Welch, of which I am now deeply ashamed. If these pages are to represent one aspect of the, quote, right wing during crucial years, they must stand with their errors, however gross. So he's very Aryan in spirit. He's not cleaning up or changing anything to make himself look better or look less of a fool than he actually was or felt himself to be at a later date from the standpoint of 1980. I cannot forbear to add, as some slight extenuation of the errors, says Oliver, that had I been asked to join the Birch Society after the summer of 1961, I should have refused. But he still had already been with him before, so he gave him 5 more years. But I had given Welch certain pledges in December 1958, and I kept them to the end. I gave him a personal loyalty so long as I could bring myself to believe in his integrity and professed purposes, and I gave him the impersonal loyalty that one owes to the commander of a large army that is the last hope of a nation. One does not desert a beleaguered army because its general has blundered. One does not leave a defeated army because its general is incompetent. One does not abandon a lost cause before one knows that the cause was lost because the general is a traitor. And that's how he closed it, but there are some notes as well. A couple pages will do them, but literally just a couple. First note, the Paul Revere's were neutralized and began to disintegrate. And remember, he had said they appeared to be on the verge of gaining major political power. I think that was in the 20s or 30s. The Paul Revere's were neutralized and began to disintegrate when some members in California wished to admit to their chapter a supposedly anti-communist Jew. Sentimental women, their heads stuffed with Christian love, etc., made of the question an issue. They communicated to other chapters, and Mrs. Elizabeth Dilling, who is really the executive director and supervised all of the administrative work, resigned because she believed that Colonel Hadley had an unchristian prejudice against the poor, virtuous, and persecuted tribe of the Lord's chosen. So Christianity interfering with anti-Jew politics. A few years after the disintegration of the Paul Revere's, Mrs. Dilling became one of the two most widely known, quote, anti-Semites in the nation, retaining her Christianity, on which she based a conviction that the Jews are the, quote, synagogue of Satan. So there's a very, very odd career. So she apparently helped destroy the Paul Revere's from a Christian standpoint, but yet years later, she's back and known as a very effective anti-Jew, calling them the synagogue of Satan, opposing them for biblical reasons, retaining her Christianity. And that was a big thing back 10 years ago, her stuff online. I forget what her site was. But she had a lot of material. She was a big name of fighting the Jews and around World War II time. You can probably find her there, but I haven't seen that website in 10 years. Elizabeth Dilling is the name. Anyway, that's note one. And then there's a subsection, a note on certain omissions. A friend who kindly looked over the proof sheets has remarked on the omission of the articles that undoubtedly attracted the widest public attention. They are both long and obsolete, and I agree with the publishers that space should not be wasted on them, but perhaps some mention should be made of the circumstances in which they were written. On 22 November 1963, John F. Kennedy was shot in Dallas, Texas, which had obviously been selected as the site for the assassination because it was the city in which patriotic sentiment was strongest. As soon as he received from Dallas the news that he was evidently awaiting, Earl Warren, head of the Revolutionary Tribunal that had replaced the Supreme Court in all but name, declaimed over the air a carefully prepared speech in which he averred that the crime had been committed by, quote, right-wing extremists, and cleverly intimated that they should be massacred throughout our great democracy. His design was marred by the mischance that a young communist gunman named Oswald was arrested and was promptly murdered by another communist, Rubinstein, or Jack Ruby, before he could name his employers. Despite this mischance, the Chief Justice's yell for blood was repeated and amplified by all the boob herds in a strenuous effort to excite national frenzy, and the great American anti-communist, quote-unquote, who had been thumping their manly chest in bravado the day before, ducked under their beds and hoped no one would remember their existence. A funeral was staged with elaborate pageantry by a unit of the army that had been rehearsed in advance for the show, and various actors, including the histrionically talented widow, gave tear-jerking performances. The press, radio, and television worked frantically to whip up the masses, in the masses, the kind of hysteria that grips savages when there is an eclipse of the sun. Welch was panic-stricken. The December issue of American Opinion was already in the mails, but a desperate and expensive effort recalled all copies, except a few that had already been delivered to subscribers. The able young editor in Belmont then prepared an excellent issue for January, including an article by the distinguished American journalist Westbrook Pegler, famous right-winger that they used to quote in. He used to be in National Review quite a bit, or at least talked about. Welch saw the issue before it was sent out and ordered all copies shredded at the printers. The two suppressed issues are shown at the end of Appendix 1. The pavidity, or cowardice, of most anti-communist was simply contemptible, and it was obvious that the Birch Society must show itself rational if it was to be taken seriously thereafter. I accordingly wrote a two-part article, quote, Marksmanship in Dallas, with a M-A-R-X, so it's a pun, for the February and March issues. The evidence available at the time indicated that Oswald's bullets had killed Kennedy. It was obvious to anyone whose common sense had not been paralyzed that the assassination had been the work of a conspiracy of which Oswald and Rubinstein had been only disposable agents. There was then no proof of participation by the CIA or FBI or the Secret Service. I accordingly stated only the facts that were then publicly known and their logical implications. After the check to their original plan, Warren and his masters decided that the best story to put over in the populace was that Oswald had been a poor lone critter who had done the wicked deed all by his lonesome. Poor lorn critter. And that Rubinstein was just an emotionally overwrought Jew. Warren was appointed the head of an illegal commission to frustrate investigation in Texas and to cover up the spoor of the conspiracy with a misleading report that was eventually published in 27 volumes that few would ever read. It was naturally exasperating that a university professor should dare to consider rationally the evidence that the mishap in Dallas had so disconcertingly disclosed. The boob herd screeched that I was a disgrace to the university and a danger to the nation, and must be hounded into obscurity, if not exterminated. Their howls, of course, were echoed in the empty heads of intellectuals and the like. The war of nerves thus directed against me was a diverting, if inconvenient, episode of which I could relate 100 amusing anecdotes. So he's a known name, a known public figure, saying this is a bunch of Marxist put-up job. The telephone rang constantly with calls from persons eager to vomit insane execrations or utter death threats. Reporters and zombies besieged the house, and the mail was packed with abusive letters, of which I had a few of the more characteristic reproduced in the May issue of American Opinion. So far as my schedule of classes permitted, I went on tours, lecturing on the subject to the great benefit of the Birch Society, until I was interrupted by a subpoena from the Warren Gang. My attorney and I took precautions to avoid disappearing mysteriously en route, and a good look at Warren made me credit the story, current in his hometown, that when he was district attorney, he murdered his own father, a local rapist who had been caught in the act, to avoid the embarrassment of a trial and conviction. That's something I've never seen anyone else say. Earl Warren murdered his own father, who was caught raping someone. Although quite a few accessories to the crime and witnesses were murdered to To prevent further disclosures, it is now known, of course, that the assassination was carried out by an elaborate conspiracy, as a congressional committee had to report on 30 December 1978. Oswald's function had been to fire shots that would cover the sound of shots fired by experts. And despite an enormous amount of misinformation and disinformation industriously disseminated, it is now clear that the assassination was an operation of the CIA, apparently carried out in the spirit of the Jews, who bomb their own synagogues so that they can screech intimidatingly at persons who wickedly refuse to believe whatever they are told by Yahweh's master race. And then there's one little note. Note one, reproduced in very small type in volume 15 of the Warren Report. So that will conclude part 3. This has been Alex Lender, and you've been listening to Learning College, Revelo Oliver's America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative. Thanks, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll pick up more from Oliver.